Hello and welcome to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And tonight we look at what it takes to be successful in your profession, what it takes to make it to the top. Because I can promise you that tomorrow morning, the alarm will go off and the vast majority of us will hit the snooze button. But a select cadre will get up before the sun rises with the sole purpose of chasing their dreams. Determined and passionate, they strive ever forward. But what is it that possesses these people? What drives them? What makes them different? Why is it some of us find success and others simply keep pace with the herd? To many, financial success includes luxury cars, big houses, maybe even private jets. To many, these items are the acme of success. But I disagree. After interviewing over 500 CEOs and self-made millionaires, going to their offices and visiting their homes, I must disagree because success does not look like a big house in Emirates Hills or a yacht in the marina or a private jet. Success looks like that individual exhausted on the floor, bankrupt and homeless, after losing everything, only to find the resolve to rise up and take the podium in what is the second greatest act of their life. Refusing to give up, success looks like that individual slumped over their computer working through the weekend. To many, success, the seed of their success, started with a failure. The beginning of their light started in the darkness. Steve Jobs fired from his own company. Bruce Henderson, founder of Boston Consulting Group, was fired from every job he ever had. And when he died, the Financial Times said debatably no other person had had as much of an effect on the paradigm of thought of business in the 21st century. That was a man who was fired from every single job he had. And in those moments when he received his accolades, nobody remembered all those firings. No one remembers the dark moments or sees the pain. They just see the big house, the big car, and they think it was easy. Well, the truth is, if you want what others don't have, then you have to be willing to do what others will not. And tonight, we find out how a small company that started in just a three-bedroom apartment in Deira, a company that literally started in an apartment and only had 10 staff, grew into a $4.7 billion behemoth. Tonight, we hear the story of how Eurus Group came to be and the man who championed its growth from a small team in an office in Deira of about 8 people out of a 3-bedroom apartment. That was the beginnings to a multi-billion-dollar organization. Deepak, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thank you, Shane. Thank you for having me at the studio.
So this all started, actually your career started in India, and did you ever think that you were going to be the chief executive officer of a massive company?
Not really, though I had a lot of aspirations when I just graduated out of college in electronics and communications. I started as a management trainee with Murphy, and the 2.5 years that I spent with Murphy gave me a lot of insight into how the various business conduct in electronics, right from production to marketing to research and development to quality control. After about 2.5 years in Murphy, I saw that my career was really not going anywhere the way I wanted it to go. And it was by coincidence that I landed up a job in Dubai with Jumbo Electronics. And so I was in Dubai in the next 3 months here in Dubai. I worked with Jumbo Electronics for about 3 years, heading one of their most lucrative business at that time, that was the Sony Video. And
but it wasn't always so lucrative, right? I think when you first came on the Jumbo, they gave you the Sony brand wasn't anything when that started.
I was given to handle some of the Sony projects that were mostly institutional business for about 6 months. And then after 6 months, Sony launched the Sony Betamax.
Okay, but before the Betamax was launched, this was actually the smallest, least interesting piece. Your colleagues at Jumbo, nobody wanted to handle the Sony account.
Exactly. It was very small. Not only Sony, but we used to handle a lot of other brands where mainly they were project-oriented products.
So there's a bit of serendipity at play. What initially you get handed as what may be viewed as a bit of a dog's breakfast turns into solid gold very shortly.
That's right. And then 1 year down the line, I was the envy of a lot of people because the Sony Betamax started growing very rapidly. And we had almost like a 75% market share in those days.
This is when you could, for the first time, make your home videos
and camcorders when you go on vacation. That's exactly it.
So they were flying off the shelf.
That's right.
In fact, I believe you had, you know, some Saudi clients that were just flying planes into the airport saying, load as much as you can on and paying you millions and
exactly.
millions.
Exactly. They were
in
not
cash.
Only customers in the UAE, but we also had a lot of re-export to countries like Iran, to Doha, to Saudi. So the business was really very, very lucrative. And almost by the time I was leaving Jumbo, the business contributed to almost 65 to 75% of the company's turnover.
So in a career, you know, on one hand, I mean, I think you were working so hard, you didn't take a break for how many years?
Almost 5 years.
5 years, no vacation. You're working 6 days a week or?
Yeah, 6 days. Almost 7 days a week, not even 6 days. This is when I joined Eros.
This when you oh this was okay so at Jumbo you weren't yeah. Well, to what extent does luck play in a career? I mean, here we're looking, there's a bit of serendipity threaded into your story. Where does luck actually play it?
Luck plays in terms of, you know, I always whenever the opportunity came and I jumped and took the risk of taking that opportunity. So whether you call it luck or, you know, jumping into the right kind of business at the right time, I really, there's the very, very narrow line to kind of tread.
But you're not very lucky if you don't work hard.
Oh, surely. I really had to work hard once I joined it off.
So, you know, why did you quit Jumbo? You're sitting here, you're the man, you're selling literally plane loads of product. Why would you throw in the towel, the hat there and move?
Actually, there was the time came in Jumbo where we were not actually selling, we were allocating stocks. So a lot of my colleagues would always tell me that, you know, your business is very simple. You don't sell, you allocate. And I felt that somewhere my career was kind of getting restricted. Though the turnover was happening, I was not learning anything new.
So there was no growth. And from how long from when you decided you were going to leave to you joining Euros was how long was that gap?
Was very quick. It was almost the day I decided. I lined up with another job in 3 weeks' time.
Within 3 weeks, yeah. And so tell us a little bit about what the beginnings of Euros was. I believe you were in an actual apartment. That was the starting.
Yeah, we had a small office with a three bedroom apartment in Dera on the creek, and we had a staff of about 7 or 8 people, including the people at the warehouse. We did the turnover of about 6 million those days, and that was a very humble beginning at that point of time.
It was 6 million dirhams when you started.
That's right.
And what's the turnover now?
Now we are at 4.7 billion this year.
4.7 billion.
That's it.
That is amazing. So I don't even know how many. That's like over more than 10,000% increase. Yeah. And so there was how many of you when you started?
We were 10 of us when we started.
10 people.
Yeah. And now we are 1,300.
In an apartment.
From an apartment at this side, yeah.
Who got the master bedroom?
Naturally, my boss, who was the owner of the business.
Okay.
And I had the very, very small room in a corner of the flat.
Okay. And who got the maid's room? That's
obviously, my secretary had the maid's room.
Okay. That's so nice. It's cozy. It's a cozy room. And so then what happens? Your career starts, and this is where you basically start working so hard that you don't take a break for 5 years. Is that healthy? Yeah. Do you think in hindsight that was the correct approach?
No, it was the passion and the desire to succeed that was there. Because when I joined the company, I realized it was much smaller than what I anticipated it to be. So rather than getting disappointed and frustrated, I took it as a challenge. And rebuild it from there on.
So you were basically hell bent on making it. I mean, how can you be that passionate about electronics, though? I mean, isn't it, you know, a TV is a TV? Or
No, because since I had graduated out in electronics, besides marketing and besides sales, I always had the passion for electronics, and I could understand the subject, I could understand the markets, I could understand the future of the products much better than anybody else. So because of that, I was very comfortable with the business.
So you were actually an electronic engineer.
That's right.
So you could understand what the transistors and all the other doohickeys in there were doing.
Though it was not necessary, but it gives you an idea of what is the future of the business and how long it can go and how long you can depend on a particular kind of business.
Do you think that's one of the issues today, is that young people are just not developing the depth in their industry specialization and moving from industry to industry or job to job without actually picking that up? So, you know, here we have an example of a gentleman like yourself who not only knows what's happening on the inside of the electronic product they're selling, understands the marketing, understands the logistics, the warehousing, the distribution, and all the 360 degrees. Is that a critical factor?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it is. But you see, I don't blame the youngsters today, because the kind of information flow that's happening to me is so much compared to the time that we had information flow. It's multiples. It's maybe 1,000 times. So I don't really blame them for this. But I'm sure, yes, at that point of time, since my foundation was very strong, it was much easier for me to maneuver the business in the direction I wanted.
But isn't it more important now than ever, because you have this excess information flow, that individuals or professionals need to become specialists? You
exactly.
can't be generalists anymore.
Exactly, exactly.
So when you're looking to hire for your company, for example, you look for that specialization.
That's right.
So the focus and specialization in one area.
That's exactly.
So when were the really key moments in the journey where you started to really feel that Euros is going to be a huge company?
Yeah, we started, as I said, I started in 1981 when the company was 6 million. The first few years, we had a very rapid growth. We were almost growing at 100%
every year on a
year-to-year basis. And even in terms of staff, we were multiplying rapidly. Then around 86, 87, we came through a bottleneck when the Japanese yen started getting very strong, and Japanese companies started getting prohibitive to import into Dubai because the product started getting more and more expensive. And by the time they could transit into other overseas countries like China or Malaysia or Singapore, that was a time when we felt that the business was not growing very rapidly.
What year was this?
This was between after 87, 88, when the yen started going very strongly.
So there was kind of the golden years from 1980 to 1987.
Of course, we had one recession in between, but since our organization was very small, we didn't really feel the impact of the recession.
Okay, and this was back in the day of the boombox, right? And
that's right.
The ghetto blaster.
That's right. We those days, even the markets were not only UAE market was very, very small, and Dubai had to depend on a lot of re-export markets. So India was one of our markets. Pakistan was another market. Iran was a very big market for us. Saudi Arabia was a very big market. And small markets into Africa, East Africa.
This is the story of Deepak Babani, the chief executive officer of Euros Group, the man who championed a billion-dollar growth trajectory. We're going to get more of his insights on how to be successful in business and in your career in just a minute. So stay with us.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. We are listening to the story of a man who took a company from 10 people working out of a three-bedroom apartment into a multi-billion dollar organization and debatably one of the largest electronic companies here in the region today. It's the story of Euros Group, and with us is the chief executive officer, Deepak Babani. Deepak, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you very much.
So what we had just talked a little bit about was, you know, how you had got your educational foundation in electrical engineering in India, had worked for one of the big electronic companies there, Murphy's, and then moved into Dubai where you got your first stride in the region with Jumbo Electronics. Then you resigned and joined Euros Group at the time when it was just 10 people in an apartment, and actually had people even working out of the maid's room to make the company work. A 6 million dirham turnover Back in what year was that?
1981.
In 1981. Today, we have over 4.7 billion dirham turnover. So when we look at the story, we were just coming up to 1987 when the yen started to really appreciate, and it really made some of the electronics a bit too expensive to purchase.
That's right. Subsequent to that, it took us 3-4 years. So we had modest growth of 10 to 15% after that until 1991-92 when Hitachi successfully moved out into Singapore, Malaysia and Thailand. And then again we had a period of growth of about 30 to 35%. But then came in 1990 when we realized that growths were not very easy, coming by very easily. And one of the things that we looked at was the IT business, but the margins in the IT were very small those days. So as a conscious decision, the company decided that we should not be getting into the IT business at that point of time. In 2000, we were very actively looking for something to propel our business, and that was the time when mobile was getting very popular. And that's the time when we acquired the distribution of Samsung fax machines. With the expectation that they would be introducing the mobile in 6 months to a year's time.
So Hitachi was actually a big player in the 90s.
That's
was
right. In the 1991, we did a turnover of about 600 million with Hitachi.
Wow.
So that was our main line, and it almost contributed to about 85% of our company's business.
And then you move into the 2000s, and
that's right.
The business is becoming more difficult at this point. Margins are getting squeezed. Competition is becoming fierce. And so how do you deal with that?
In 2000, we had two big products that propelled our growth till 2007. One was the flat panels, which were very new those days. So they started with the plasma, and then we moved on to LCD and then the LED. And also the second product that was propelling growth was the mobile phones. So we acquired the distribution of Samsung mobile phones, and we had the distribution of Samsung and Hitachi color TVs.
And then that brings us up to where you
2007.
Are. 2007.
Yeah, from 2007, there was a recession. And there were a lot of companies that the buzzword was how to downsize our companies because people did not know how long the recession would last. At that point of time, we sat down with our key managers and thought, what should we do next? And contrary to the general trend that people were retrenching people, we decided that we will not retrench. We will continue to keep whatever staff we have, but watch the markets very carefully. The reason for that was that we did not know how long the recession would last. And if we had to recruit people back on the jobs, it would take us at least a year's time, and which by the time we'd lost business. Luckily, our gamble proved very successful. So in 2007, when people were recording negative growths, we had a 25 to 30% positive
in 2000,
growth.
It was 2008. 2008, the end.
Yes.
Or 2009 was when the heat really turned up, I think. And that's when the cars were in the airport and yeah. All the other fun
That was
stuff.
The time we grew by 25 to 30%.
25 to 30% yes. in the crisis.
In the crisis.
How did you do that?
One of the things that we did was we at that point of time, we got into the IT business. And also we had another division, which was called the Lifestyle Products, where we took the distribution for Sonos. We also took the distribution for TCL TVs in 2009. That helped us to propel the growth to 35%.
Wow. So, and then at that point, is that when Dubai Mall was opening in 2009?
That's 2009, yes, that's right. 2009, 2009.
Okay. And everybody thought it was going to flop because it was 30% full.
Exactly.
This huge mall.
Exactly.
And now, you know, you can't walk through the mall.
Yeah. Currently, the records show that last year they had a footfall of 55 million, and this year they're expecting footfall of about 75 million people.
It's unbelievable. But isn't in that number, though, it's the same person as being counted. Because if you go to the mall four times in the week, you're getting that counting, right? So that brings us up to kind of where we are now. And is that kind of that's kind of the new age now store concept of what you have kind of like in Dubai Mall with the different, you know, the huge product range. It's almost like a superstore. You can get almost anything except your groceries there when it looks at the from an electronics perspective. Has that always been kind of the model, or is that a new concept that came?
As the products, especially mobiles and TVs, start getting, I wouldn't say complex, but, you know, with adding more features onto them, we wanted to show people or consumers that it's not as difficult to operate as they think. So the concept of the Dubai Mall store was that we gave them a more of a touch and feel kind of experience, and so that they can find that, you know, though these are high technology, in terms of operation, they're not difficult to handle.
So when you look at it, you've been in the business for decades now. You've faced bulls, bears. I think you've even gone through a few wars in the region. What do you feel has been the biggest challenge or crisis that you've had to take head on throughout your career from the beginning? What would you say has been the most challenging moment?
I think there are two moments that were very challenging. One was during the Gulf War, when you found that the motivation of people was very, very low. There was a lot of uncertainty in the market. And that's the time when, again, everybody around were almost stopped importing goods. And we, at that point of time, decided that we will continue to bring the goods because we had calculated what could be possibly the downfall could be possibly accumulation of inventory for 2-3 months. Luckily for us, things turned out our way, because even during the war, when the Kuwaitis came here to Dubai, they were large purchasers of electronics and appliances. Also, those days, there were large amount of Marines, European Marines who were here, Italians, the French, and the English, who were major buyers of electronics and appliances. And therefore, the business boomed at that point of time. In fact, I can recall that the period of the Gulf War, our profitability that particular year was probably the highest in history.
Wow,
in terms of percentage.
It takes a bit of an iron constitution, though, to, while the market seems to be falling apart, to put your money down and be purchasing more inventory. And you know, as you increase that working capital, I'm sure you start to run a liquidity risk.
Yeah, though, but you see, we had done our calculations and we had talked to our owners, and they gave us the kind of backing that, you know, we wanted. And luckily for us, that worked correctly.
So that was the biggest
decision. That was one time. And also, as I told you, the 2008-2009, the financial crisis was another period where was a very tough decision. To keep the motivation of the staff, we did not retrench. We took an opinion contrary to what other people were doing. And again, that proved very positive for us. I think those are the two periods that I find were the most challenging in my career of 30 years with Ross.
Because you think if you get that wrong, then you run into that cash flow issue.
Yeah, we knew that, but we knew that what was the bottom line where we could possibly go, and then we took that risk and it paid off.
But now, isn't it getting a bit, I heard the electronics business is getting very tough because the margins are just getting thinner and thinner.
You're absolutely right. So at this moment, what we do is we are re-engineering our business to see that how we can increase the productivity of our staff, how we can automate our warehousing, how we can automate our systems. So a lot of automation in terms of hardware, software, in terms of logistics is going on in our organization to see that we can match the expectations of the future.
Right, and I guess also the customers want to have a higher service, higher touch service. That's because good. You have these smart TVs, and a lot of people aren't smart enough to use them. so you need somebody to come
exactly.
and show you how to use it, right?
Yeah. So we have been re-engineering that, and again we have been very successful. Most of our consumers, when we do our 3 months consumer service, we found that we come out with very high ratings.
Very high ratings. This is the story of Deepak Babani, the chief executive officer of Euros Group, a 4.7 billion dirham turnover business. He's going to be sharing his insights into running a business, his strategies, philosophies, management, North Stars, and more in just a minute. So stay with us.